Creative the Digital Revolution. It explores the power of collaboration and the impact of the arts and humanities on technology. I am very pleased to have Walter back at this table. Welcome.
It's great to be back at the table.
Let me just tell you about this. I love this book.
Thank you, sir.
I love it because, A, I love the subject matter. B, I love your narrative skills. And you're introduced to people that you didn't know. Mm-hmm. You know, Ida Lovelace, I had no idea about her.
We know the people who invented the computer and the internet, leaving aside the Al Gore jokes, you know, these are absolutely creative, wonderful people, and we don't know enough about them. We use their stuff every day. It's like the American Revolution. We know everybody involved, and that's how we know what our country is. To me, it was like, let's figure out these people who actually did the digital revolution.
So tell me about the beginning of it, because you set out and have thought about writing about the internet, period. Mm-hmm. And then you had a conversation with Bill Gates.
Right. Early on, as you remember, because we did things on the show in the early 1990s, I was in charge of digital media for Time, Inc. And I had a boss who asked me, well, who owns the internet? And I thought that was, A, a very clueless question, and B, I decided I really better figure out how it came to pass, the internet. And so I started gathering string, talking to people like Tim Berners-Lee, Vint Cerf, all the pioneers. And I was gathering things for a book, so when I interviewed Bill Gates, he said, no, what was really the combustible mixture was a combination of the internet with a personal computer. And they both come up together, and then they finally join. You should do all the pioneers of the revolution.
And so you have went out to get them. What's interesting, too, is it's just it's in the innovators, but it's also the power of collaboration. You see how this is not one more book about the lone genius achieving great success.
You know, those of us who write biographies, we have a dirty little secret, which we don't like to admit, which is that we distort history a little bit. Yeah. We sort of make it look like there's a guy in a garage or a garret who has a light bulb moment, or a gal in a, you know, somewhere who thinks up something. You look around at all of us, what we do in our lives, most of the good ideas actually come from collaboration, teamwork. And when I did Steve Jobs, he's the ultimate of this great visionary. But and he's a strong cup of tea. You had a great interview with Tim Cook, and he explained the core of Steve Jobs. But Tim Cook is a good example. Steve knew how to create a team around him who were incredibly loyal. So even though we think of Steve as this, Steve Jobs as his lone visionary, I came to see he created a very loyal team to execute his vision.
And that's one of the principles we'll get into that you talk about. Collaboration is a central element of being able to achieve what real innovators have been able to achieve. I said Ida Lovelace, was it Annabelle?
Ada. Ada Byron. Yeah. She was Lord Byron's daughter. Only legitimate child. And, you know, her father was a great romantic poet. As you may imagine, Lady Byron was not all that fond of Lord Byron by the time Ada was growing up. So tried hard to make sure she didn't become a poet, and had her tutored mainly in mathematics, as if that was some antidote to being a mathematician. And Ada Lovelace, she becomes the Countess of Lovelace, realizes that if you join poetry, the arts, to technology, it was the same as those weaving looms that were coming up in the Industrial Revolution that used punch cards to make beautiful patterns. She said, we can use punch cards to make anything on our computer. And so she comes up with the concept of a general-purpose computer by connecting the notion of sort of the humanities and art to science and technology.
You see that a bit with Steve Jobs and Johnny.
Yeah, well,
represent this sort of...
Yeah, the collaboration between Johnny Ive and Steve Jobs was it. But Steve Jobs, in his first long interview I had with him for my book, said, I was an electronics geek as a kid, but I love the humanities and arts as well. And that's when I realized that standing at the intersection of the arts and technology is where you'll create great value. And that's what I put in the DNA of Apple. Mm-hmm. And you remember all those product launches. He always ended with a slide of the liberal arts and the technology as a street sign. And he said, that's where we stand.
Yeah, you talk about that in the first biography, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's also Alan Turing, who we're getting to know now because this new movie is coming out called The Imitation Project.
The Imitation Game.
Right. Tell me who he is and why he's part of this book.
Alan Turing is so fascinating. He worked at Bletchley, the secret facility in England that broke the German wartime codes. And he comes up based on Ada Lovelace, who he read, this notion of a general purpose computer. It was more than Ada Lovelace.
Yeah, they didn't call it a computer. They called it a machine.
Right. It was a universal computing machine that he does. And now we call it a Turing machine, which can do any logical sequence. But he and Ada disagreed. They're a century apart. He's exactly, you know, in the 1940s, a century after Ada Lovelace. But he has what he calls Ada Lovelace's objection. Because Ada Lovelace said, machines will never think. They'll do everything except think. Humans will have to be the creative ones. And Turing said, how do we know machines will never think? He came up with the notion of artificial intelligence. So he comes up with a test to say, how would we define a machine that could think? We'd say, well, you put a machine and a person in a different room, and you feed them questions, and if after a while you can't tell the difference between the machine and the human, then you have no reason to say the machine's not thinking. And that's called the Turing test or the imitation game. This movie is great, and it's about Alan Turing at Bletchley Park. But here's the thing about Turing. His life was almost a refutation of the notion that we're no different from our machines. Alan Turing was homosexual, you know, quite upfront about it, but he had to keep it secret when he was breaking the German wartime codes and in England.
Among other reasons, against the law.
And so he gets arrested for gross indecency, finally. And he's given hormone treatments, and, you know, it's really bad. And, he seems to ride with it for a while, but after he's written this notion of the imitation game of the computer, a few years later, he bites into a cyanide-laced apple to commit suicide. Now, is that something a machine would do? And it almost helps you realize the emotions and, you know, that come with being human are fundamentally different these days than what a machine does.
Steve Jobs' Apple has a bite out of it.
You know, early on, my daughter said to me when I was just starting to think about working with Steve Jobs, she said, you know, the Apple logo, that's an homage to Alan Turing. I said, I didn't know that. So Steve, being Steve, he'll answer emails right away when he's left. I emailed him and I said, Steve, is that the case? And he emailed right back and he said, I wish we had been clever enough to think about that. I think about that all the time now. But when we first did it, we didn't think of the connection to Alan Turing.
True story that your daughter came home having written an essay about Lovelace and said, I've just written this essay on this exam about
Well, it was Lovelace. Her college entrance essay. And, you know, my wife was like, why haven't you done your essay yet? You know, it's your senior. Yeah. And finally, Betsy comes down and says, here's my essay. It's on Ada Lovelace. And I knew who Ada Lovelace was, but I wasn't quite sure what she had really done. I said, well, what did she do? And she explained what Ada Lovelace did. And that became the framing device for the book, because the concept of the general purpose computer, but one that's tied intimately to humans, as opposed to, as artificial intelligence enthusiasts would have us, you know, replace as humans, that's what Ada was all about. So the last chapter is called Ada Forever. And it's about how everybody from Alan Turing to Sergey Brin and Larry Page, who do Google, or Jimmy Wales, who does Wikipedia, it's tying intimately computers in a personal way, putting it on your wrist, putting it on your eyes like Google. And so, to me, the Ada Lovelace vision sort of frames the book and takes us all the way through Google.
Where do you think we are in terms of artificial intelligence and the development of artificial intelligence?
I think that we're always 20 years away. In 1957, they started, right after Turing does the imitation game, the perceptron that was going to mimic the human brain. And they announce it. And the stories in the newspaper say things like, you know, they unveiled a computer that will think like the human brain and be able to be conscious and recognize people, etc. Every year almost from 1957, including this year, you can just Google it this year, people have written those stories saying we're a few years away from artificial intelligence. But it always seems like a receding horizon when in the meantime, the Ada vision or the vision of people like Steve Jobs, Alan Kay, Doug Engelbart, that you combine the talents of computers with humans, that keeps growing by leaps and bounds. In fact, that's what they're doing with Watson, who, you know,
IBM Watson.
Yeah, who kind of could win at Jeopardy. But to make it really powerful, IBM is now sort of pairing it or partnering it with intelligent humans.
My impression is that the velocity of change towards understanding or developing artificial intelligence, whatever the level it is, is increasing dramatically because of how much stride we are making in understanding the human brain.
Yeah, but it's like there's an old saying that, you know, it's
an standard is not to be able to recreate.
Right. And as Bill Gates once said to me when I was asking him that, he said, you know, we could reverse engineer the human brain and do it in a wetware carbon-based system instead of silicon. He said that would be cheating because that would be reverse engineering what nature did. But he said it wouldn't work either. But there's an old joke about, you know, artificial intelligence has been growing by leaps and bounds for many years and it's about to reach its infancy. I still think we haven't reached the infancy yet.
Really?
I went out to, you know, Applied Minds in Los Angeles. Right. They have a robot and it can, you know, go across the room. But it can't pick up a crayon, can't write its name, can't do it.
Better.
Right. And you go down here in Manhattan to the domain awareness system where it's looking things. Yeah. It can't pick out a mother's face in the crowd. It can't. Now, what about all these things? Who can do those? A 3-year-old can. Yeah. A 4-year-old can. So I don't think artificial intelligence should be our holy grail. Sure, we're going to get closer, especially when we get really good speech recognition, better than Siri, where you can really have a conversation like the movie as opposed to Siri. But, you know, I don't know that that should be our holy grail. I like what Google is doing, which is making machines more intimate with us, what Apple is doing with the watch. The holy grail should be make a partnership between humans and machines, not create machines that can exist without humans.
The interesting thing, too, is that the people who are running those companies, especially Google, those guys are scientists. Those guys are engineers. Those guys are people.
That was one of the things Steve said to me. When the marketing people or the finance people take over the company, it no longer innovates. He was criticizing Microsoft and Steve Ballmer at the time. But Larry Page says it, and I quote it in the book, in my interview with him, he says, the reason we can be innovative is that our engineers and our product people run the company. So that's one of about 30 rules I would extract from the book, is make sure product people run the company. That's even true at Amazon. And, you know, Tim Cook was more of a manager, but he really has good product people around him.
And is able to create the culture of collaboration that Steve
absolutely.
Did, or continue it, that
oh,
kind
absolutely.
Of culture of collaboration.
Right.
When you think of the word innovation, I mean, it's like one more article in Harvard Business Review.
Yeah.
You know, and when I first saw this, I said, where's Walter going? You mean something different.
Well, innovation is such an overused word,
buzzword.
It's been sapped of a lot of its meaning. And so my point was, let's not talk about innovation in the abstract. Let me show you exactly what Bill Gates did, what Steve Jobs did, what the people who invented the transistor at Bell Labs did, and how that Bell Labs system led to something. So I wanted to look in a storytelling way. This is a book, a narrative book. It's storytelling. It's not, you know, 12 easy lessons of innovation. Because I wanted to do some real reporting and say, how did they make that creative leap and how did they do it as a team? But who was the visionary that helped make the leap? Because you need a visionary and a team. So it's more of a book about real people who actually do it. And I'm trying to rescue the word innovation. I mean, innovation is such a buzzword that you know, people always think they're going to do a website explaining innovation to you. I just want to say, well, let me report it. Let me show you what happened all the way through Google and Wikipedia and, you know, the things we have today.
We live in a global world now, as everybody knows. And when you look at China and you look at other places in the world, for a long time, we always took pride in the fact that the Googles and the IBMs and Xerox and Apple all came out of Silicon Valley and out of the United States. IBM didn't come out of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
But, and the other countries could not create a Silicon Valley. Is that still true?
It's still true. We have to be a little bit cautious. Let's take Google. Sergey Brin, you know, his parents are Jewish. They're in Russia. They immigrate, and they're saved by the International Rescue Committee. They're brought to Maryland, and he studies math, and he becomes a co-founder of Google. I think we need to keep our immigration system fixed if we want the best and the brightest, not to come here and study and then go home, but to get visas to work here.
Yeah. So the reason so much comes out of the United States is because we're getting all the smart people from other countries.
Well, you know, it's not bad to be a brain magnet, to have all the smart people from other countries. And secondly, whether it's Russia or China, people don't feel, you know, comfortable with the free flow of information.
Right.
I mean, you see what's happening in China this week. So I think we're very comfortable ever since the days of Ben Franklin and Thomas Paine with handing out pamphlets and the free flow of information. We've got to preserve that as well. And thirdly, I'll take a woman programmer who helped create ENIAC. Her name was Jean Jennings Bartik. She was also from Missouri, a tiny town of Atlantis Grove, less than 200 people. But she goes to Missouri State College And she decides she wants to become a mathematician. And she ends up being the person who programs with five other women ENIAC at the University of Pennsylvania. She paid $78 a year to go to college. That college, Missouri State, is now $14,000 a year. We've got to make sure we have a K-12 education system and a higher education system that attracts everybody.
You said a wonderful thing. I know it's not in the book, but it was, I think, a quote from you about, it was about the equality of opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, that if we lose that,
right,
you know, unless we make sure we recapture that, because differences in education and things like that are creating an inequality of opportunity.
You know, the digital age and the technology revolution has a couple of things it could do. It could help improve education worldwide, like edX is doing.
Right.
Secondly, it could either equalize the opportunity of people everywhere to have access to information, including people who aren't in grade schools in this country, or it could widen the digital divide. I don't believe technology has its own personality. I think it's only as good as the way we use it. So I would really hope that the next wave of the digital revolution is dedicated to being inclusive, to making sure that the prosperity of the digital revolution is open to all, not just to
the elite. Well, one thing this book points out is the fact that there have been a lot of women who've made real contributions and have not necessarily been recognized for it.
You know, women were more recognized and made more contributions in the early days of computing, partly because men were all obsessed with the hardware. There were a lot of women PhDs in math in the 1930s and 40s. They come to work during the war. They programmed Grace Hopper. I mean, just an awesome person. She's, when Pearl Harbor happens, she leaves her husband, leaves her job teaching math and Vassar, and joins the Navy.
Yeah.
She ends up programming the Mark I at Harvard. These women do. And so women pioneer programming, which is exactly what Ada Lovelace did, too.
Which reminds me, I didn't know this, and I'd forgotten that Steve had said this. Steve Jobs' hero was Robert Oppenheimer.
Yeah, he liked the fact that Oppenheimer could make a team work together to create the atom bomb. And what did
the Manhattan Project.
Manhattan Project. And what it was bringing the best minds and the best engineers and the people who knew how to, like, screw things in and be mechanics and had grease under their fingernails. He made them all work together, not for any glory, because it was in total secrecy. And that was the ultimate collaboration and teamwork. And when Steve talked to me about that, that was one of the things that made me think, okay, that's why I need to do a book on all the people of the digital age, not just another singular biography.
Didn't you test chapters of this book on the Internet?
You know, that was something I was writing one night about the early Internet and how it was used for collaborative research.
Right.
That's why they invented the thing. And I said, well, why don't I try to do that with this book, use it for collaborative research?
Right.
And back in the early days of the Internet, there were a lot of bulletin boards and news groups and things. It wasn't like just websites. And I said, well, where's a place like Wikipedia I could put something up and other people could edit it? And I tried quite a few places, but the one I liked the most was Medium,
right,
which was created by Ev Williams, who created both Blogger and then was a co-founder of Twitter.
Right.
And I put up chapters on Medium. There's a whole section in there about Dan Bricklin and how they created VisiCalc. Why? Because I put up the software chapter, and he and a few other people said, here's what we did when we created the first application software, which is a spreadsheet software. And I said, that's interesting. So I put that in the book. And I hope someday we'll have a way where we can collaborate on books online, where somebody like an author would maybe curate it, but everybody can contribute, and we could divvy up the royalties, maybe with a Bitcoin payment system, so you could have Wikified or collaboratively created books. But this book is informed all the way through by posting chapters and allowing people to make comments.
You've talked about here technology and the humanities. Bill Buckley famously said to me once, talking about having run once for elective office, that they thought people either cut out to be actors, i.e. a politician, or observers.
Right.
I mean, have you ever been motivated to try to create something in collaboration with other people beyond media, which is your home?
Yeah, no, I've done a lot in media, and I guess I'm more of a storyteller. I mean, where I grew up, there's Walker Percy, the great novelist, talked about
this.
There are two types of people, preachers and storytellers.
Right,
he said, for God's sake, be a storyteller. The world's got too many preachers.
Yeah.
But also, I like bringing people together. As you know, we've done a lot of things together. We bring, starting with the Time 100 back in the 1990s, let's bring people together. So I don't know that my talents are as a manager or somebody who can execute and run. You know, I ran CNN, and I must say I wasn't the best at being a tough executive. And so, you know, I think you do what makes you comfortable.
And you look at what was the lesson that came out of that experience for you?
I think you
other
learned
than I wasn't a tough manager.
Well, I think you learn that you have different passions and talents.
Right.
Yours has not been let me run, you know, PBS.
No,
yours
no,
has been
no.
let me bring people to this
no,
table.
No, let me run anything.
Right. No. And I think you got to learn, and that was a learning experience for me, that sort of being a heavy-duty manager and boss, it didn't, you know, wasn't my passion.
Yeah.
My passion was kicking around ideas with people, trying to get people to do some good things. It was fun at Time Magazine when I was there because that was a smaller place. I knew everybody. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to the Aspen Institute where I am now, which is smaller,
right,
bring people together and work on certain ideas. You just have to learn what your passions are. And storytelling, to me, is the greatest, you know, fun I have because I think you can sort of bend the world a little bit by saying, let me tell you a story.
You know,
and that's what the book is about.
Aspen and the Aspen Institute is sort of the founder, it seems to me, of the idea of bringing smart people together, interesting people together, not only because of the cross-fertilization, not only because of the networking, but also you'll hear some interesting ideas at these places. Yet it seems like they're happening everywhere now. I mean, you can't pick up the newspaper and see where the New York Times is doing or Financial Times is doing it. I mean, everybody is. What is the essence of that? Why is it that they're so popular, other than some people make a lot of money?
Yeah. One curious thing is that we thought that the Internet, you know, with its networks, would allow us to network virtually, have friends on Facebook, sort of convene in Google's chat rooms. One of the lessons of this book, and Steve Jobs knew it well, and the people at Google, Larry Page and Sergey know it, is that, and Marissa Mayer, when she took over Yahoo, knew it, is that you've got to get people together, that collaboration and creativity happens in person, that Googleplex beats Google Hangouts. You know, you just, when you get people together in the flesh, they're able to do things. That starts in my book with Bell Labs, which gets really smart people together, but it goes all the way through Googleplex, Yahoo, and others. So with this ability to have friends around the world on Facebook and communicate via Twitter or WhatsApp or everything else, it increases our desire to get together physically, not decreases it.
Absolutely.
I think it probably goes back to Aristotle, who said man is a social animal. So it's nothing new, but even the Internet, you know, it's being used for connectivity, but then that wets the appetite. We thought we were all going to live off and off, you know, and sort of telecommute from Montana. People move to San Francisco, New York, Boston, New Orleans, and Austin. They want to be around other people in the flesh. I don't think that's ever going to change. In fact, you know, what I've seen at the Aspen Institute and you've talked about is it sort of whets the desire when you've done something online to then actually sit around to discuss it in the flesh.
You, in an article in Vanity Fair, you know, you wrote the five lessons of the digital revolution. Connect art and science, we've talked about. Creativity comes from collaboration, we've talked about. Collaboration works best in person, we've talked about. Vision without execution is hallucination. Tell me about that.
Well, there's so many people, starting with John Vincent Adanasoff, who had a vision for a computer but couldn't put together a team and execute it, all the way through people like William von Meister, who is a crazed dude who started a whole lot of Internet companies in the 70s, including AOL. But they all went down in flames until AOL got Jim Kimsey and Steve Case to be able to execute it. And even the Google guys had great vision, but they bring in your friend Eric Schmidt, you know, when they need to have, you know, for an early period of that company, when they needed to be able to execute. So I think we, you know, if you go around to all these conferences you've talked about, everybody wants to show you their really cool vision. I say, well, let me pull up my iPhone and use it. Say, well, no, it's just a vision at the moment.
Yeah.
And I say, well, a vision, if you're not going to execute
and
it, is hallucination.
And technology behind it. I mean, one of the early things
And
I
they
learned.
Don't create teams.
That's right. But it has to be right on the basis of technology.
Right. You know, that's why
vision.
I want to pull it out and I want them to show it to me on my machine.
Exactly right. The last thing in this list is man is a social animal, which we have talked about. This this is a great book, Walter. The Innovators gives you real insight into these lessons, which are applicable not only to being an innovator, but also to life itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie.
A forward here. The author, the subtitle is what I meant to say, how a group of hackers,
geniuses,
and geeks created the digital revolution. Walter Isaacson, thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Keeps you connected on television, online, on the radio, and on mobile.
Opportunities aren't always obvious. Sometimes they just drop in. CME Group can help you navigate risks and capture opportunities. We enable you to reach global markets and drive forward with broader possibilities. CME Group. How the world advances.
Sailing through the heart of cities and landscapes with Viking, you'll see things differently. You'll get closer to iconic landmarks, to local life and cultural treasures. It's a feeling that only a river can give you, that only Viking can give you. Spend less time getting there and more time being there. Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort.
Some said, the sun has set on Japan's economy. We said, more favorable growth policies mean Japan's economy will eventually rise. Singular insights, superior execution. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. Voted top global research firm, 2011, 12, and 13.
How do you start your day so you make better investment decisions?
You watch Bloomberg Surveillance to find out what the markets are doing. And you talk to smart people. Bloomberg Surveillance, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
Perceptions change and evolve. In a recent Bloomberg Audience Insights report, more and more IT decision makers evaluated Android as a secure platform for large-scale business operations. In the survey, 72% of IT decision makers said they had deployed an Android device as part of a bring-your-own-device initiative. Among them, more than 9 in 10 had deployed an Android device from Samsung. One reason they trust Samsung Android devices is the Knox security platform. 79% believe Knox is extremely or very useful for application security, with 78% mirroring that sentiment for malware protection. Samsung is in the unique position to offer security that is deeply rooted in hardware and constantly moves forward to help business realize the full potential of mobility.
I think that the Malaysian government creates a very business-friendly environment. They've been working alongside us throughout the 40 over years. We wouldn't be where we are today without that support. And obviously, that support would continue.
Malaysia is at the forefront of success. We have very talented people, world-class infrastructure, and we provide a very strategic environment for businesses to grow.
Ships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
I'm John Heilman.
And I'm Mark Halpert. And this episode, with all due respect, this episode is going to end with a walk-off dinger. Tonight on the show, Chris Christie is agnostic on the right. Mitch McConnell's opponent seems agnostic on Barack Obama. And Texan Wendy Davis appears to be flirting with the devil. But first, two crises that have taken over the political world, starting with ISIS. Here's a potential Fox News lower third from the future. Obama loses Baghdad. ISIS is now gaining territory, and while they haven't taken the Iraqi capital yet, the terrorist group has planted itself firmly in the midterm elections. Check out this new TV ad from Arkansas Senate candidate Tom Cotton.
In the Middle East, radical terrorists are on the march, destabilizing our allies, beheading Americans, and crucifying Christians. President Obama admits he underestimated them. We need a senator who will hold the president accountable and make America safer.
So, John, this Wall Street Journal story this morning suggests that ISIS is on the march, not being pushed back. Right. John Kerry talking about the fact that there's going to be times when there are losses and setbacks. Right. How big a prospect is there for an October surprise now caused by ISIS?
Well, it's not going to be that big a surprise in the sense that this ISIS problem has been building slowly. But the impact on the elections could be quite a surprise in the sense that it looks like the bombing campaign that we're waging now, if it's doing any good whatsoever, it's not having a dramatic effect. And the notion that ISIS could end up in Baghdad before Election Day,
let's say they get close to Baghdad or they take territory. Yeah. Do Republicans just jump on that?
Yeah, they're already starting to jump on it now. Even just at the first hint of that kind of loss, they're already all over.
And then what do Democrats say? If Baghdad falls or some key area falls, what do Democrats say?
Well, they end up trying to talk about things that are not foreign policy. But for the Democrats that have voted with Barack Obama, who are incumbents, it's going to be a lot harder to change the subject in that way.
Yep, no question. All right.
All right. The other crisis that's on our plate is Ebola. Yesterday, we heard the news that a nurse in Dallas has been infected with the disease. That's the first person to contract Ebola in the United States. Meanwhile, John McCain, despite his general aversion to czars of all stripes, is now calling for an Ebola czar in the White House. Mark, is this public health issue about to dominate the midterms?
I think John McCain is not only giving good public policy advice, he's giving good political advice to the president. You watch his briefings, we keep talking about this, you see a different officials, pretty low-key, Texas officials and federal officials. I think the president would be super smart all around to pick one person with a commanding presence, have him go on TV and talk daily, maybe twice a day, about what's going on, because politically now he's setting himself up for the same kind of criticism that he's gotten in the past about not being commanding enough, not getting on top of a big issue.
I have been amazed about the fact that this White House has not kind of designated a Norman Schwarzkopf-like figure, someone who has public health credibility but also has communication skills, political savvy, who's out there on television absolutely every day leading people through this rather than kind of seeming there's five or six different faces of this crisis.
Now, you think about how long we have to the midterms, a few weeks. What's, you know, leaving the public health aside as a political issue, what's sort of the worst case for the Democratic Party now?
Well, I think, you know, the Republicans have to tread carefully on this, right? Because even though a few of them have gotten into the fear-mongering game, most of them do not want to be accused of that. So I think what you're going to see is a lot of atmospheric ads that are going to bundle this ISIS thing with this Ebola thing, in the sense of the world is spinning out of control, we're losing our control of our destiny, the sense of kind of dark foreboding.
And again, what do Democrats say in response to that?
Well,
they change the subject to minimum wage?
Yes, I think there really is no good answer to that. They must try to fight on ground that works for them, which is on specific policies about the future, about things that voters care about in the long run, like education and jobs and health care and stuff like that. But it's hard to fight the really powerfully done negative atmospheric stuff.
There's not much the president president do to keep Ebola or keep ISIS from being a huge October surprise? If things happen on the ground, it's bad. It seems to me they can get ahead of the Ebola thing. It's not that big a public health crisis right now. He just needs to do some basics, including listening to John McCain, getting a czar in place. All right, Mitch McConnell tonight debates his challenger, Democrat Alison Lundgren Grimes, in Lexington, Kentucky. It's their one debate of the whole campaign in that key race. One question that's almost certain to come up: did Grimes back Barack Obama for president? It's the subject of a new and deviously timed McConnell ad. And as Will Ferrell's version of Harry Carey would say on Saturday Night Live, it's a simple question.
Alison Lundgren Grimes' refusal to say who she's voted for president is now the non-answer heard round the country.
Did you vote for President Obama 2008, 2012?
You know, this election.
She refused to answer.
Dodging whether she voted for President Obama.
And Kentuckians expect her to cast a tough vote on anything? Is she ever going to answer a tough question on anything?
That is a political tactic as old as my Kentucky Colonel's T-shirt, which is to release an ad on the day of the debate to frame the things. Yeah. How big a deal in the debate and in the rest of the campaign is her non-answer going to be?
I think it's going to be a pretty big deal. I mean, look, this is not a hard thing. Ask me. If I'm Alison Grimes, ask me if I voted for Barack Obama.
Did you vote for Barack Obama?
I did, Mark. You know why? Because I'm a Democrat. And in each case, against Mitt Romney and against John McCain, I thought it was clear that Barack Obama would be better. Have I agreed with him about everything? No, I have not. But on the key issues of who would lead the country forward, I am a Democrat. I voted for my Democratic president.
Yeah, McConnell is...
You got to just answer the question. You got to answer the question.
McConnell is smart. They could have put this ad out right after this thing started at the ed board. They didn't. They waited till the day of the debate. It puts her in a very tough position. And even if the moderators and questioners don't ask her about it in the debate, you can bet McConnell will.
She looks like a weasel. And then on top of that, by doing this, she's just now raised the question of her closeness to Barack Obama in a way that's rebounded against her negatively on that level, too. It's like she's lost and lost and lost on this.
And her campaign tried to go back on the offensive, but until they answer this question, I don't think they can go on the offensive.
Absolutely crazy.
Yep.
All right. As the New York Times reported today, the Christian right is not entirely hot to trot for Chris Christie. They fear that when they look at him, they don't see the kind of ardent culture warrior that they're looking for as the next Republican presidential nominee. Over the weekend, Christie gave a speech to the NAACP that seemed to suggest that the religious right may be right.
I believe that every life is an individual gift from God.
Yeah.
And that every person is precious and needs to be treated that way. Now, you know, it's easy for some in our society to say that they are pro-life when the life is in the womb. See, they haven't disappointed us then. But people come out of the womb and they make mistakes. And when they make mistakes, we need to decide, are we pro-life then too?
Mark, if I know you, and I think I do, there's a lot in that clip that you liked. But the question is, how big a problem is Chris Christie have with the cultural conservative right?
This is the most overrated thing since the Washington Bullets drafted Kenny Green out of Wake Forest. How's that?
Okay.
Totally overrated. Look, every Republican who runs, every Republican, Ted Cruz is going to have problems with the right.
Yeah.
Chris Christie has a lot of conservative positions. He's got a record of winning, and he's got good political skills, which you saw there. And if you go on his website, you can see that whole speech. He's not a perfect candidate for the right, but if he gets in this race, raises money, and is strong, I think this is a totally bogus, overrated thing.
I think one thing you and I totally agree about is that in either party, in order to be president of the United States, you got to take on your base on some things.
You have to.
It's absolutely a sine qua non.
Particularly now.
Especially in this Republican Party. And in this case, he's not actually attacking the Christian right. All he's sort of saying is, I'm not going to kowtow to the Christian right. And their power is not increasing. It's ebbing, if anything.
Liberals who've written him off and conservatives written him off don't understand how strong his skills are. There's a reason why he was considered a huge national player. Bridgegate set him back, but he can give speeches like that. Very few people in the party who can, and he's aggressive. And when you have a problem and you're aggressive, you go fast and hard, and he does that. I think this thing is totally overrated. You have problems with the right? Sure. But they're not insurmountable.
And that's just another way of saying, I share your values, but we got to look at it in a slightly different way.
Exactly.
And so he's not really trouncing them. He's just basically saying, hey, guys, you got to look at this in a different
exactly.
way.
Exactly. All right. You know, when pretty much the whole political world thinks you've probably gone too far, you've probably gone too far. Wendy Davis, the Democrat, is running for governor in Texas against the state attorney general. That's Republican Greg Abbott, who since an accident in 1984 has used a wheelchair. There's a new Davis ad that went on the air Friday, and since then, the ad has been roundly condemned as both inappropriate and politically stupid by almost everyone.
A tree fell on Greg Abbott. He sued and got millions.
Since then, he's spent his career working against other victims.
All right, huge backlash against this ad, but does it matter? Does it impact Wendy Davis's chances of being the next governor of Texas?
Well, it does not, because Wendy Davis had virtually no chance of being the next governor of Texas.
And now?
Even before this ad, even still has no chance whatsoever. I was down at Austin City Limits this weekend, and I talked to Democrats and Republicans, people on the far left, the far right. Everybody thought this was a ridiculous, horrible, tactically horrible, strategically horrible.
All right, let me play devil's advocate. Abbott's shown himself in a wheelchair in his ads.
Yes.
And all she's trying to do is to say the guy benefited from suing when he had an accident, got a lot of money, got justice, and now he's opposed to the kind of torts that would allow other people in accidents to make claims.
There is a perfectly respectable intellectual argument that this is a fair ad, but it is totally trumped by the optics of you've put his wheelchair in this ad, you're using his handicap against him, which is, of course, the way she's being mammoed now. You know, I think there's a chance that she will lose this race by a larger margin than Bill White lost his race to Rick Perry 4 years ago. He lost by 12 or 13 points. She was supposed to be the candidate who turned Texas blue, or at least turned it purple, and I think she's just about to get slaughtered in this race.
You know, it takes a lot to get the Texas media against one candidate, particularly a Democratic candidate, in full force. And that, as you said, that's what happened here. She, I think, to some extent, potentially, not just this move, but some of the other missteps in the campaign, she went from being a national hero to the left and a lot of Democrats now to, I think, not only losing badly, but potentially ending any prospect of being a leader of the party in the future.
Well, and setting back the cause for Democrats in Texas.
That's right.
All right. So last night, in dramatic fashion, the St. Louis Cardinals beat my San Francisco Giants with a walk-off home run, evening that series at 1-1. Tonight, the Orioles are in Kansas City at Kauffman Stadium, the K, to try to mount a comeback in the ALCS. Mark, you're a former Beltway boy, grew up rooting for the Orioles. Yeah. Do your Orioles, I know they're not really Orioles, do they have any chance of coming back from 2-0?
They lost 2 at home. They're against a momentum team with a lot of speed that
Cinderella.
Plays well at home. Cinderella. I mean, it's possible, but I would not bet 40 cents on the Orioles to come back, and I wouldn't be surprised if this thing ends in 4 or 5 games at this point.
You think that my Giants have a better chance in that series?
Oh, yes, I think they do.
Fantastic. Glad to hear that.
All right, coming up. Oh, are we? Yes, we are. We go deep inside the Rushmore State with former and potentially future Senator Larry Pressler on the four-way fight that could decide the whole thing and control the Senate. That's coming up next.
Next.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Koch Industries. Learn more at KochCareers.com.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Koch.
Perceptions change and evolve. In a recent Bloomberg Audience Insights report, more and more IT decision makers evaluated Android as a secure platform for large-scale business operations. In the survey, 72% of IT decision makers said they had deployed an Android device as part of a bring-your-own-device initiative. Among them, more than 9 in 10 had deployed an Android device from Samsung. One reason they trust Samsung Android devices is the Knox security platform. 79% believe Knox is extremely or very useful for application security, with 78% mirroring that sentiment for malware protection. Samsung is in the unique position to offer security that is deeply rooted in hardware and constantly moves forward to help business realize the full potential of mobility.
Biggest political characters in South Dakota are not the quartet of presidents whose faces are on Mount Rushmore. They are the four guys running for U.S. Senate. And one of them, former Republican, now independent, Larry Pressler, is our guest tonight. Senator Pressler, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
The entire country, at least the political world, is surprised that South Dakota is suddenly the most exciting Senate race. Are you as excited and as surprised as the rest of the political world is to find yourself in this position?
Well, I've been working for 2 years from 4:30 a.m. to late at night, and I'm going to be talking about issues to the people of South Dakota. I'm doing retail politics. I've only spent about $160,000 on the whole campaign. So it's truly amazing that with my competitors have between $6 and $9 million expenditures. So it's a grassroots campaign, and if it succeeds, it could start a precedent. I think we need to elect more independents to the Senate. It appears we'll have one coming from Kansas, maybe. We have two independents there now. That would be four. Maybe that's enough for a small caucus. But we need to change the United States Senate. I want to be a powerful, independent voice for South Dakota. And in the new Senate, an independent can be very powerful because we'll probably have a closely divided Senate. And that means that if one has the ability to work with both sides. Also, I'll be bringing my seniority back to the Senate. And South Dakota needs that in terms of power to offset the Burlington Northern Railroad and some of the great corporations that are not serving our farmers and grain shippers well.
Senator, you've supported President Obama in the past. Let me ask you about the big topic, one of the big topics facing him now, which is dealing with ISIS. What's he doing right in terms of confronting ISIS? And what would you say he's doing wrong in confronting ISIS now?
Well, I was co-host of a fundraiser for Mitt Romney and contributed $2,500 to Mitt Romney. So I'm not tied absolutely to Barack Obama. At the time, I felt it was the best vote, but I disagreed with him on many points. I think that we need to change our policy to a new policy of containment, where we use the Powell Doctrine to use our most lethal weapons to accomplish what we're trying to do, not ground troops. I'm a Vietnam combat veteran, and I feel that our time in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan has been largely wasted.
Just in general, Senator, do you approve of the job the president's doing in confronting ISIS right now, or you disapprove of the job he's doing?
I disapprove because it's ill-defined. I'm against sending the weapons into Syria. I would support brief bombings, but also the use of anything we've got, drones or lethal weapons, to accomplish what our goals are. But we should not go into endless war. I feel the military-industrial state has got us in a state of endless war, and it just drags on and on. And I am opposed to getting involved in foreign civil wars. I'm not an isolationist. I would say my thinking is maybe more libertarian in that area. But we need to develop a new doctrine of containment of our enemies when we want to, but we should use our most lethal weapons quickly and get out. We cannot remain engaged. There is a professor at Boston University, Basevich. I assigned his readings to my class. It's about endless war. Our military-industrial state has got us in endless war, and it's a state of mind that we just cannot resist. And I hope President Obama does not put boots on the ground in any form.
Senator, are there specific policies and areas on domestic affairs where you would not be a reliable supporter of President Obama?
Oh, many. I'm very much a deficit hawk, and I guess I meet the press. They said that they thought I would caucus with the Democrats. That's not necessarily true. I'm taking Senator Angus King's advice. I'm going to wait till I get there where I can get an agreement to have certain roll call votes. That's the caucus I will join. I feel that the Senate seldom votes on anything, but our deficit in particular is out of control. But that doesn't mean we're going to take from senior citizens and take from the poor. But it means that we have to both enhance revenues, and do that by a 3% tax increase on millions of on incomes of over $1 million a year.
Senator,
I'm all for lots of. Yes.
Sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt. This is a four-way race, as we said. You and another independent. You've got a Democrat, Weiland, and former Governor Rentz. Handicap the race for us. Who's the favorite? How's it going to go?
I don't know. I've got very little money. I've said that I'm like a rabbit on a hill, and there are several men with big shotguns coming, because I only have about $300,000 in my whole campaign account, and $100,000 of that is a loan I got from a Sioux Falls bank.
So under that scenario, Governor Rounds is Elmer J. Fudd millionaire. You're the rabbit.
Well, no, but there are outside groups coming in attacking me.
Yeah.
The Republican National Committee attacked me when I Yes, I'm under attack from the Republican National Committee, the Republican Senatorial Committee. I'm very surprised because I was a Republican congressman and senator. I was picked the Republican Senator of the Year in about 1991. So I'm very sad that they are doing that, but they're running negative ads, and then there's an independent PAC running negative ads about me, and the Democrats are running negative ads. So I'm opposed by the Republicans, the Democrats, and I've only got about... I've got a total campaign budget of about $300,000, which most of which is spent.
All right, Senator Pressler, sorry I tried to get the Warner Brothers metaphor in there. We appreciate you joining us, Senator Larry Pressler in South Dakota. Senator, thanks so much. And up next, which Republican candidates would beat Hillary Clinton in Iowa in 2016? Who's the most popular politician in the Hawkeye State now? And is Black-ish the runaway comedy of the fall? We'll answer at least two of those questions when we come back after the break.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by BP, proud to be America's largest energy investor.
When folks think about what they get from Alaska, they think salmon and energy. But the energy BP produces up here creates something else as well. Jobs all over America. Engineering and innovation jobs, advanced safety systems and technology, shipping and manufacturing. Across the United States, BP supports more than 250,000 jobs. When we set up operation in one part of the country, people in other parts go to work. That's not a coincidence. It's one more part of our commitment to America.
Gunderman Group.
Gunderman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
The goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups.
They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time? Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 I love logistics.
We all have to plan for retirement. But when we start worrying about tomorrow, we miss out on what matters today. At AXA, we offer advice and help you break down your retirement goals into small, manageable steps. Because when you plan for tomorrow, it helps you live for today. Can we help you take a small step? For advice, retirement, and life insurance, connect with AXA.
Try the new Bloomberg Business Week Plus app for Samsung phone and tablet and get your first year of Bloomberg Business Week free. You'll get deeper intelligence on global business, innovative companies, technology trends, and exclusive behind-the-scenes videos and interviews. Start your free Bloomberg Business Week Plus subscription on your Samsung device today.
Hillary Clinton's path to the White House runs through Iowa twice, first in the caucuses, and then perhaps in a general election. We wondered, how'd she do in some matchups with potential Republican rivals as mythical as a polka-dotted unicorn? Well, those results and more from the Bloomberg Politics Des Moines Register Iowa poll are now available in full on our website. And with us here to discuss the whole tamale of the poll is Bloomberg View's Al Hunt. Al, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
So I want to start with these. Go ahead.
I've never seen a polka-dotted tamale, but let's go.
All right. So these matchups with Republicans, pretty striking to us. Hillary Clinton loses to Mitt Romney, barely beats Paul Ryan within the margin of error of Rand Paul. How surprised are you that in a state that President Obama carried pretty handily twice, that Hillary Clinton is neck and neck with those three Republicans?
Yeah, a little bit. She's not going to scare anybody off with those sorts of numbers, though. But let's not forget, Mark, Obama did carry by 6 points last time. But this is a very purple state. Bush carried it in 2004. They elect as many Republicans as Democrats. And when I look at that Republican field against her, Mitt Romney says he's not going to run. We'll see. Paul Ryan's going to be Ways and Means Committee chair. What really impresses me really is Rand Paul. He does better than all the others, and he's within the margin of error with her. Now, I think that's really noteworthy.
That is a little surprising. Just stay with that for 1 second. He at Rand Paul ahead of both Chris Christie and Jeb Bush, who are presumed more Republican favorites. Does that surprise you as much as it surprises me?
Well, yeah, because the line from establishment Republicans is we need a Chris Christie or a Jeb Bush because they can win in a general. and a Rand Paul, the others can't win, but Rand Paul does better than they do in what will be a very contested general election state.
All right, let's look at the Senate poll, at the results of the Senate poll, too, Al. Here we have a neck-and-neck race. Bruce Braley with 46, Joni Ernst with 47. Ernst was up a couple weeks ago when the last Iowa poll took place. Joni Ernst was up by 6 points. Braley has closed there. What do you see in the crosstabs that's interesting to you beyond the top-line number?
Well, I guess it's not surprising, John, but Joni Ernst, of course, they hope maybe they would bridge the gender gap a little bit. They have not, but she's doing a lot better with men. There's about a 15, 16-point gap with Braley doing better with women and Ernst doing better with men. I guess the thing that really did jump out at me was that Joni Ernst, a very conservative Republican, does a lot better with younger voters than does Bruce Braley.
Al, go ahead, crazy speculate. Why is she doing so well with younger voters, do you think?
Well, you know, they probably like hog castrators. That was
huge with the youngsters these days.
They really does. Boy, does that resonate. I'm not sure of the answer, Mark, but I think if Braley wants to win this thing, he's got to close that gap.
Yeah. So, Al, the two most popular politicians in Iowa, according to our poll, are two guys who I would say could not be less alike. Terry Branstad, the current Republican governor, is going to cruise to reelection, and Bill Clinton. What is it about Iowans that they like those two guys?
Well, and throw in Chuck Grassley, too, who's enormously popular.
Right.
Can you imagine anybody more different than Grassley and the big dog? I think that they are authentic figures to Iowans. They're authentic political figures. And I think Bill Clinton comes across as someone who identifies with them. Terry Branstad is about to be elected for the sixth time, certainly identifies with Iowans. And it transcends ideology, as it does in a lot of states, Mark.
Al, last question is, I think, about President Obama. His star has faded in Iowa. That was the state, obviously, that launched him to national prominence in 2008. He won the state again in 2012. But our poll shows him with a high disapproval rating in the state overall. Only about 27% of voters saying they support him as much as they used to. Do you think that hurts President Obama when he hears that? That he's even in Iowa, he has suffered so much?
Oh, it's got to, because that state has a 4.5% unemployment rate. The economy's doing a lot better. As you said, this is what started him. He carried it twice. It's got to hurt. The other thing, John, that was striking to me was to look at how hawkish, at least for now, Iowans are. Henry Wallace has turned over in his gravestone.
Al, you are a font of wisdom, as always, and we're pleased to have you here. Thanks, Al. We'll be right back.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Mercedes-Benz, engineering some of the most advanced vehicles on the road today.
The lightest or nothing. The smartest or nothing. The quietest or nothing. The sleekest, sexiest, baddest, safest, tightest, quickest, harshest, or nothing. At Mercedes-Benz, we do things one way or we don't do them at all. Introducing the all-new C-Class. The best or nothing.
Introducing the new and improved Bloomberg app for your iPhone and iPad. Financial markets change even when you're away from your desk. Bloomberg gives you a snapshot of what's moving, plus breaking news, video, and sophisticated portfolio management tools. Download the free Bloomberg application and stay ahead wherever you are. Also available on Android, BlackBerry, and Windows Phone.
I think that the Malaysian government creates a very business-friendly environment. They've been working alongside us throughout the 40 over years. We wouldn't be where we are today without that support. And obviously, that support would continue.
Malaysia is at the forefront of success. We have very talented people, world-class infrastructure, and we provide a very strategic environment for businesses to grow.
Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
We are only on the air a half hour a day, but we are live 24/7 on BloombergPolitics.com. There is a bunch of great stuff on the website right now. The thing I want to point you to right away is Dave Weigel's piece, Taking Exception with Our Conventional Wisdom, about Wendy Davis's ad. He says, everybody hates the new Wendy Davis ad. That doesn't mean it's a failure.
Lots about our previous Bloomberg Politics, Des Moines Register poll on the site, but there's one coming tomorrow. You're going to hear all about it here, 5 o'clock tomorrow. Stick around, though. Taking Stock is next on Bloomberg Radio. You can catch Bloomberg Law.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success.